Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, this is Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat. Welcome to our second show. Thank you for all the feedback I got on the first one. The sound production is about 18% better on this one. Thank you for all your tweets, and please leave a review and subscribe at iTunes. Good show this week. We've got an interview this week with the author of one of the most entertaining business books of the year. And also joining me in the studio is someone I've long admired and respected, one of the most respected people in UK media. Joining me is Dara Nassar, for the MD of UK's Twitter.
Hello.
Lovely to meet you, Dara.
I know you, though.
Okay. we work together, don't we?
Yes, that's right, we do.
But we're not going to be talking about work or anything like that. So we've got a good episode today. I guess the theme of what we're going to be discussing is the interview in the second half of the show. But as you're here, Dara, I thought it'd be worth getting to know you. So talk us through you and where you've worked in the past.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I've worked in this industry for 17 years, primarily in television advertising. Well, at the beginning, in television advertising, and latterly, 4 years at Twitter and almost 6 years at Google.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
Not in media, if I'm honest. I didn't know what I wanted to be. I suppose I'd had the whole footballer, fireman kind of thing. But I just wanted to really, I don't know, I quite enjoyed television, I enjoyed entertainment, but I really never knew what I wanted to be. I still don't really.
Does your mum even understand what you do? I think that's the curse of modern jobs, isn't it? When, at least footballer, fireman, your mums could understand the job you do.
I think you make a good point there. You once said, when we were chatting, when you watch a film, you often have people who are doctors or lawyers or maybe accountants, but they never sell media, do they?
I think that's it. There's certain jobs where you can be a protagonist in a film. So you know, a university lecturer, great protagonist in a film. Someone who deals with capping oil wells, great protagonist.
Yeah.
Someone who manages accounts queries, yeah, in a credit control department, not a great protagonist.
Not great protagonist, more of a joke figure, probably.
Yeah,
To be true, the job isn't the main part. Yeah, so my mum, I mean, she understands the industry. So tech she gets, and she's heard of the brand, so she's very proud there. But probably couldn't explain what my primary focus is.
And what was your worst? So our aim in this podcast is to talk about happiness at work and work culture. What was the worst work experience that you've had?
Yes, I've been very lucky.
Good work at good companies, haven't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I've been very lucky since graduating for working for good companies. But I did some temp work when I was at university and after university. And I worked for a telecommunications, you know, with temp work, you go to a temp agency and they tell you what to do. You know, you don't have any choice. All you say is, how much do I get an hour? And I think at the time it was like £4 or £4.50 or something. And I worked for a telecommunications company. I thought, that's
good. What does
that
even mean?
Exactly. I thought, that's good, isn't it? It's tech or something. But it was, they hired lines from British Telecom and they sold them to old people for cheaper than British Telecom paid at the beginning. And then they ramped the prices up.
Right.
And my job was credit control. So I had to phone 85-year-old people and say, why haven't you paid? And then try to threaten them for money. Ooh. That was a pretty bad job.
How long did you do that?
2 hours. So, yeah.
How many people did you menace?
Well, none, actually. So, okay. Well, no, what, that's not true. I got the list, and the woman who worked there said, you just have to phone these people up in this order. I'd phone them up. And I realised, you know, obviously you don't know their age. You just get a list of people with a name. All of them were old. Right. I mean, you could tell straight away. So I sat next to the sales team who were selling these things. And I said, weird, isn't it? All the people, like first 10 people I phoned are old. And he looked at me and went, they're all old. All our leads are old because old people buy this. They believe what you say. Right. And, then I left.
Wow.
Well, I actually said to the bloke when I was leaving that it was morally corrupt and I left.
That's it. I mean, then I was noble really, of you leaving, but
I was really scared. I know.
The world.
I mean, that was noble that I left, but then I spent the next day worrying about what my mum would say.
Right, yeah.
She was all right about it, to be fair.
My worst job, I used to dress up as Mr. Wimpy. I mean, it wasn't
That's
my worst job.
That's an amazing job. That's better than your job
I
now.
I used to dress up as Mr. Wimpy. But when when Wimpy was sort of still like Burger King, I was 5 foot two till I was about 17. And one of the cushiest jobs was that you would don this fiberglass costume and go out onto the streets of Birmingham, stand next to someone handing out vouchers that said you could get a quarter pound for one.
Did anyone hit you?
No, but routinely Birmingham City fans used to roll Mr. Wimpy, who had a broad brimmed hat, that'd roll him down Corporation Street. And there was basically only about three people who could fit into the Mr. Wimpy costume, me and two young Asian girls.
Right.
And quite often you'd see a young teenager coming into the building crying because Mr. Wimpy had been manhandled in some way.
My one's worse. My job is worse.
I think yours is just shows the dark side of Britain.
Yeah. Maybe not Britain, of the world, maybe. I mean, I assume that happens everywhere. You know, a friend of mine worked again for a company, and he said as well, when you're doing cold calling, you have likelihood of people, you profile people likely to buy. And those people are older, or people they profile as less educated, which is exploitation, really.
Yeah. But you've worked at some nice companies along the way.
Lovely.
But have they always been... I'm just interested... The thing I'm interested in is it's not necessarily the companies with the most resource that are the most happy. Is there anything that you think successful businesses do well on culture? Or what? When were the times that you were happiest?
More than the companies. For me, it's like 97% of the people. So you can be a brilliant company that has great culture, that pays you well, that... great benefits, but if you work with people that don't set the right tone, that defines it for me. So very small companies that aren't well heard might have a great culture. I mean, I do have to say the word culture is a difficult one for me because I don't think there's a specific definition to it. You know, when you talk about it's very intangible. And I think if you said to someone, Google, for example, is said to have a fantastic culture, and it does. But I think a lot of people perceive that with the benefits that come with the culture.
Right.
Whereas I have a friend who works for an insurance loss assessor, which isn't a great necessarily industry, but he loves working there because the boss makes sure they have fun, they can go early on a certain day, they've got flexible working, they can buy extra holiday days, stuff that actually means a lot to them. And because of that, they're like a family. So I think it's really defined by the people, the experience, how the leadership act or react.
Because benefits, I think, have got nothing to do with culture.
They don't, but I think if you say we're someone with a good culture, sometimes people think, how well do companies pay?
Yeah.
Or what's their pension? Or how many holiday days? And that's more of a package, I think.
It's just an interesting thing that quite often when you look at what the best places to work, they'll often give this laundry list of the things they provide.
That's right.
And quite often there doesn't seem to be a connection between it. Mm. I've worked at some places where they gave you absolutely nothing, you know. They wouldn't even refund your bus fare to go and visit somewhere.
Yeah.
But they've been heroically fantastic places to work.
Don't get me wrong. Like, I mean, Google, I was very lucky to work there. I loved it. Absolutely loved it, but my happiness was defined by the people I work with.
Right.
Or my lack of happiness was defined by the people I work with, not by the broader company or Mountain View where their headquarters are or how lovely the lunch is. Of course that helps. Of course we're very privileged, Marie.
Did you ever go to Mountain View?
Yes.
Can you see mountains? I presume that name conjures, is it an alpine retreat?
I mean, to be fair, it's interesting that no one's ever thought of that. Yeah, I think there are mountains there.
It's a pretty big claim, though, isn't it? When you build a complex to say Mountain View, I'm immediately thinking...
Yeah, it's a good point.
It's in the midst of the Swiss Alps.
I could have been in Croydon, to be fair. Okay. I was in a training room.
Right, a business park.
Literally that. It was... It's But the company owns the whole town. I mean, you know, it's a pre-existing town they've taken over.
Right.
Basically.
Let's kick on and play the interview and then we'll come back and chat. So today's interview is with Dan Lyons. Dan Lyons has written probably the most entertaining business book of the year, Disrupted My Misadventure in the Startup Bubble, a story of a fish out of water, the story of a lack of diversity in the promised land of tech startups. So to give a bit of context, Dan was a successful writer who, amongst other things, wrote the blog The Fake Diary of Steve Jobs. And his book tells the story of someone who didn't fit. It's a darkly amusing book, made more alarming by the fact it's true and very relatable. He lifts the lid on the dystopian elements of the 21st century working culture. It ends with his pursuit by hackers trying to break into his personal affairs. Brilliant insight, strongly recommended. I met Dan, who now spends his time as a journalist and a screenwriter on the HBO comedy Silicon Valley, sitting next to former Twitter CEO Dick Costolo, by the way. I met Dan on his recent visit to London. Yeah, I mean, just out of curiosity, and we're going to go on and talk about your experiences working in a tech company. But before we start, I was just fascinated to just briefly cover the fake Steve Jobs thing. And I guess, you know, from my point of view, I remember fake Steve Jobs when it was happening. But just reading through the book and recollecting on the stories of him hanging out with Bono and doing peyote and sort of fake calling restaurants. How did you even come to find yourself doing that?
I very much by accident. I really wanted to just learn how to blog, and I thought I really wanted to learn about about online publishing, about HTML, like literally just how to do things online. Because at Forbes, working in print, we were very isolated from the whole production process. And even if our stories went online, we just wrote them and sent them over and someone else took care of it. And I was very curious about blogging. Blogging was this, you know, hot new thing. And I started a whole bunch of blogs on different platforms just to see how does TypePad compare to WordPress, compare to Blogger. And, you know, and it was really just one day I had this random idea of what would happen if you had a CEO who was blogging but who was horrible. And you couldn't stop him. Like, the PR people couldn't. Because, you know, there's the Robert Scoble idea of naked conversations, and every CEO is going to have a blog, and this will be great. And I remember thinking at the time, no, that would be horrible. And the few CEOs I've met, I think if you got them a little drunk and had them just home blogging, you'd be appalled by, you know, the kind of sociopaths you're dealing with. And so I thought, wouldn't that be funny? I used to read Private Eye a lot, and I remember they used to always do the diary of someone. And I thought, oh, a blog is kind of a diary. What if you did that? And so that's why I called it The Secret Diary of Steve Jobs, because it was, I think Private Eye always calls it The Secret Diary of John Major. Yeah. Remember those?
Yeah.
And they were, you know, I always thought them really funny. And but I didn't intend to continue. I just thought it was something to do for a few weeks. And then people started reading it, and it kind of took on a life of its own. And I sort of realized very accidentally this thing was taking off, and it was a way to write about the tech industry. At first, it was sort of just a few little jokes about Steve Jobs, and then I realized, you know, what am I going to write about every day if I'm going to keep doing this? And I thought, oh, what if Steve Jobs was opining on the tech industry? So it was a way to cover the industry as a journalist and to say things that I kind of wished I could write in my Forbes articles, but I couldn't, but put it through the voice of Jobs. So it had to be filtered. It had to be believable that Jobs might actually think X. It wasn't too hard to imagine how he might. I think some things I got things wildly wrong. Like, that's probably not how he felt. But yeah, so it was. There was another guy at Forbes who, he and I had both had this idea to try to do a daily show of tech, like do what Jon Stewart did with politics, but about tech. But nobody would ever let us do it. But it was a way to, because, you know, I mean, you've been in the tech industry for a long time. You're around it enough, you start to think, there's so many absurd things about this industry, and yet the coverage is all so straight and so boring, and wouldn't it be fun to do that? So, yeah, that was the impetus for that. It was just a way to write about tech in a funny way, which, of course, now there's a lot of that, but at the time, there wasn't much. Yeah.
I absolutely loved your book, and I think the reason why I loved it is because it's so rare that you read something that's so savage and sort of satirizes what you see. I mean, I compared it, I think, to David Eggers' The Circle. I don't know if you read that, which is sort of quite gentle, and whereas this names the company that you worked at, and satirises them to just an extraordinary extent. Do you feel any anxiety being as honest as you are? I mean, like you document the troubles that you had at the end.
I had a lot of anxiety. In fact, I thought maybe there's a novel in this. At one point, I thought maybe that would be the way to write it. But I have not read that Dave Eggers book, and a lot of people have mentioned it to me, and I know I should, and I've just been busy, but I'm going to read it. I had a lot of anxiety writing the book because I thought, well, there might be some backlash. Obviously, there was. I mean, I ended up getting hacked, and I don't even know what happened because the company won't say. But there was this FBI investigation. It got all very scary for a while. In the end, I kind of felt it worked better being a real story about being a nonfiction book. It actually worked being, you know, using my name and saying this is really what I went through. And
so, do you want to describe sort of briefly your experience? So, for anyone who's not ready. The experience of a writer, of sort of a career in writing in publications like Newsweek, and you find yourself in an East Coast, but a tech startup.
So and I was a tech journalist for a long time, and the thing that sort of forced my hand is I got laid off at Newsweek, and so found myself trying to either find another journalism job or maybe cross over and work in tech, which is something I had thought about for a long time while I was covering tech. And I think a lot of people who cover technology companies have this fantasy of like what must be like to go behind the curtain and just be in one of these companies. I suppose sports writers maybe have the same fantasy of like, wouldn't it be great to play for the Red Sox? But you know you could never play for the Red Sox. But when you're covering Google or IBM, you realize, oh, I could maybe do something here. You know, it's not impossible. And everybody there seems to be having so much more fun than you are as a journalist. You know, the people in especially successful tech companies. You also don't realize, I think I didn't realize as a journalist, you don't see a lot of the really horrible failing ones because you never write about them, right? Which is actually 99% of tech companies are the ones that just completely flounder and go out of business. So the ones you're writing about are the ones that are the rocket ships that are taking off. And you know, when you visit Google as an outsider and you walk around that campus, you just think, this is like Disneyland. This must be amazing to work here. You don't really feel that way walking around HP. I don't think anybody walks around HP going like, oh, wouldn't this be magical, right? Or EMC, you know. But anyway, so yeah, I had this fantasy. And so I started looking for a job in tech. And I kind of thought, it happened to be at a time, too, when tech companies were all hiring journalists to do this sort of brand journalism or corporate journalism. And I sort of thought, well, okay, it'll sort of be half a loaf. It'll still be kind of a journalist, but I'll be working for a company. A different company will be signing my paycheck, but I'll still be independent and writing whatever I want, and I'll be writing this blog about business. So, yeah, I went to work at a company called HubSpot, which is a very small startup, pre-IPO, but doing well kind of company. It was growing very fast. And I thought, well, this would be fun. I'll go for the ride and see what an IPO is like from the inside as a company goes public. And then got in there and realized that I really didn't fit culturally. It just was really bad fit. And I had overestimated my ability to adapt. I thought I could do this. I got in and fairly quickly realized that wasn't going to happen, that it was just a bad fit. But I stuck it out sort of stubbornly saying, I'm going to make this work and I'm going to carve out my place here. So it just kept getting worse and worse. And so the book is sort of a comedy of errors of you know, a guy. I was twice the age of everyone there. That was another problem. So I had never felt old before. Suddenly I was very much aware of my age in a way I'd never been before. And it just felt very different from everybody else. It was a place where there almost was zero cynicism. And I had never been in a place where really there was just a complete lack of cynicism. And
was that, did that come across? There's one amazing scene that I loved where you're given the four archetypes, the four personality types, and the robot man you're asked, and you start riffing. Is it worth you describing the scene? You start riffing, and actually it just seems remarkably humorless as a place as much as anything.
Were afraid to laugh. Yeah. So we did this DISC training, which is, it's sort of like Myers-Briggs, and we went through this training where you get assessed. You're either a D, an I, an S, or a C, or some combination of those, or it's a pie chart. So you might be a D with a little bit of I. And, you know, it seems obviously kind of ridiculous and hokey and pointless. You know, I think a room full of journalists either wouldn't put up with it or would really do it under duress and would be making fun of it the whole time. So we had to go and you do an online test, and then you go show up one day in a room full of people and you get your little packet that tells you what you are, and as if you're, you know, and you're dying to know what you are, right? And we had to guess what we thought we were, and then open our packet and are you, you know, and then we had to watch these videos of different personality types and see which to learn. Like this, so the basic premise was a D and a C might not relate very well. So it's if I know you're a C and I'm a D, then we should each know what each other's are. So then I know how to talk to you, and you know how to talk to me. And there was one type, I can't remember what it was, that was essentially, yeah, the robot man,
yeah,
who would just do exactly what they were told, nothing more, nothing less. And so in the corporate videos, they made these videos of these people talking, and they were actors, so really bad actors with a really bad script reading. And this guy gave this thing about, I do exactly what I'm told. And like, you know, if you said to him, where's that report? And he said, well, you didn't tell me to give it to you. You just said to, I told you I'd have it finished by Friday. He's like, well, anyway, so stuff like, so they went around and asked us, which one did you like the least? And I said, you know, the robot man. And they sort of said, why? And I said, well, I didn't like his mustache. And then nobody laughed, right? And it's like, you know, it's just the way he looked. And maybe it's, if not really the type, maybe it's the actor they hired, and still nobody laughed. And then it kind of went on this ramp. Like I said, actually, I think if I had to work with him, I think I'd want to strangle him. I think I would literally put my hands around his throat. Like, how did you end up in this company? How did this company hire a robot? And, like, you know, this is a startup. And the woman got more and more ill at ease, the woman running the training, and said, well, I think I know what you mean. You mean that you would be frustrated and it would be difficult for you to talk to him, wouldn't it? And I said, no, I mean, literally, I would strangle him. I think I really would kill him with my bare hands. And still nobody laughed, and everybody kind of looked around like, oh, there's a crazy man in the room. And then she said, well, you know, some people in this room are C types, whatever they are, and you're not going to strangle any of us, are you? Ha, ha, ha. And I was like, no, of course I'm not going to strangle you, you know? And then there was just this awkward silence, and it just got very uncomfortable, and finally it was over. And I sort of apologized afterwards, but they were kind of mad that I had sort of made fun of the whole thing. But that was a moment when I realized I was not in Kansas anymore, right? I was not right really where I belonged.
And is your feeling overall then, so is your feeling that the experience you have was an environment that didn't want diversity, and they talked about diversity, is that because they perceive their success comes from the way they've done things to date?
Yeah.
What was your final, I mean, it's sort of, you know, stories of people doing push-ups in meeting rooms and, you know, this sort of locker room bro culture. I was just interested whether you felt like the company was trying to assimilate you and bring you in or experience diversity.
Well, that's the other question I had. I couldn't understand why they had hired me. Like, because I got there and realized everybody else was under 30. Really hardly anybody over the age of 30. So I was twice the age of everyone there. And there were no other people my age. It was one guy in the entire company of 500 people. And, I came to think, yeah, there's this idea of culture fit. That was very big there. And they sort of said, like, we like to hire people that would like to go have a beer with after work. It's really important to fit in here. Like, being a fit is a big thing here. And I came to think that was a euphemism for a lack of diversity. And I sort of went into startup land as a think of it as an ecosystem, thinking, oh, this is, you know, the modern world is going to be very progressive, very diverse, very cool, hip, and lots of different people. This would be great. And then I got in and found out not only were there no people my age, and that was on purpose, they were intentionally only hiring people who were very, very young, there was also a lack of diversity along the line of race and gender in the sense that there were a lot of women, but none of them in top roles. But it was an incredibly white place, and all of sort of one kind of white people. And it was very important to go along. So there wasn't much friction and dissent at all. And I think that was part of the problem. I think that happens a lot in startups, that it's very important to buy into the vision and not dissent. If you're a dissenter, you sort of get pushed out, which ends up being a problem ultimately, I think.
Yeah, because I mean, these the guy who carries the teddy bear around, there's a series of sort of odd things.
And nobody laughs.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Not only does the founder bring a teddy bear and think this is great and tell everybody why this is a great idea, nobody makes fun of him. That was what was funny to me, was that in any organization I've been in before, I think some of us would be, you know, making fun of that, you know.
Is that a... time change, as like, because British businesses, I think, have humour appears to be part of the workplace, whereas the painting you create here is that a lot of really junior people who sort of first jobbers quite often, you know,
yeah,
someone's your manager after they've, you know, you ask what their last job was and people are baffled because it's only college. But that lack of humour just seems to be an extraordinary thing. I mean, what are the cultures that you've enjoyed working in? What's the difference?
But I think partly it's an American thing, right? Like, right. I think, honestly, like, my best friend back home in the States is an English guy. And I spent enough time here and in Ireland that, you know, I think people here have... I don't think... I just have a hard time imagining that any of this could happen in England. Because you know, I mean, if you look at English comedies and TV shows, I mean, there's just a much deeper level of cynicism here and piss-taking, right, than there is in the States. I think that level of earnestness and lack of cynicism is a uniquely American thing. Maybe not, but I think it is. And I was always in newsrooms, which are very, very cynical places. Even, I mean, to the extent that we're journalists are very cynical about the outside world, we have to be, you know, you sort of anything any PR person says to you, you immediately think is a lie, right? And or any corporate person says you immediately think is, or you start trying to poke holes in it. But even in our own company, like we would, at Newsweek, we were in a death spiral, right? And we'd have these meetings where they just laid off half the staff, and then the remainder of the staff would get together, and, you know, the boss would get up and say, look, things are great. You know, we did just cut half the staff. There might be another cut, but it won't be more than 15%. But things are good. And yes, we did just leave our headquarters into a much smaller space, but things are good. And you know, we'd all sit there and kind of nod our heads and then go out and say, well, that was bullshit, right? That was, I mean, but we knew that guy had to get up and say that. Yeah. Or this woman had to get up and say that and rally the troops. But at the same time, and we had to kind of nod our heads, but then we kind of all would go like, you know, kind of like sit in our office and talk about how grim it was. I had just never been in a place yet where there was no cynicism. It was amazing to me. It really was. It was very culty. It was very much like when you, I read Lawrence Wright's book about Scientology just as I was starting this job. And it was a little bit like that. And you realize there's people inside Scientology who really don't understand why people criticize it. Like, why do you hate Scientology? We're so great. We do such good things for people. So, it was amazing in that regard. Really amazing.
And do you think the experience would have been different had the company been doing incredibly well?
They were doing well. I mean, they were growing really fast and then they went public. And the stock has gone way up, you know. They've never made any money. But, you know, in a way, they were doing well. So that's the other thing. It made me think maybe I'm crazy because whatever they're doing seems to be working, right? So they weren't going out of business, right? And they almost ran out of money. I mean, they were burning through money really, really badly, and they went public having borrowed money to keep the lights on. Like, they came as close as you can get to, like, running out of money. But they managed to pull it off, and they raised a bunch of money in an IPO, and they're, you know, still going. So, yeah, that's the one big caveat. It makes me wonder if maybe I'm just a dinosaur and I'm stuck in the 20th century. Like, I'm the only one who thinks maybe everybody now brings a teddy bear to work and that is the way to go. And I'm just the old guy who thinks bringing a teddy bear is stupid, you know? It's another thing I wrestle with in the book. It's like, am I out of step? Have I, you know, just lost it? You know, which is, I think, what they would say. Yes, that you're...
I guess it combines with you. I saw a quote from Marissa Mayer a couple of weeks ago saying the reason why Google's a success is we worked 130 hours a week, and, you know, there's been quotes by other tech sort of heroes really saying that, you know, younger people are better than older people.
Yeah.
So it must combine to it does add to that sense that diversity doesn't necessarily feel like what they're after.
No, I don't think so at all. They put out these reports every year with these statistics, but I think it's just... And every year the headline is always like, this year's diversity report shows little progress. I think the VCs especially would love it if all of you young 23-year-olds would come in here and work 130 hours a week for us. That would be great. Please do that, right? You know, and there's a reason for that. And they get rich. Yeah, maybe there's something to that. I mean, I'm not sure if Marissa... Well, I wouldn't argue with her. I mean, she knows what made Google great, but
it's just hard to see that accommodating a family, or hard to see it accommodating living remotely where you've got to travel home.
Right. I mean, that is the and I've heard people say that, you know, they sort of women who can't get hired because they say, well, you know, I mean, it's funny, we look back on the old days of like the Mad Men era when women couldn't get hired because they're like, well, you might get pregnant, or if you get married, or we won't hire married women, you know, and we sort of scoff at that as being an old-fashioned way, but it happens today where women are kind of told, like, you know, if you have a kid, you don't come back, or if you're pregnant and you get fired, or women don't get jobs because they're afraid they're going to want to have kids, right? And I think that kind of retrograde thinking still applies in Silicon Valley. And yeah, there is a sense of, I had someone tell me about HubSpot where I worked in the sales department. They were on monthly quotas instead of quarterly, and it was a really grueling environment. It was just very hard to make your number every quarter. And a woman said to me, that's why look around. There's no one here that has kids. First of all, nobody can survive this very long. You do it for a few years and you're burnt out. But, you know, you can't have a family and do this job at the same time. I think that is kind of an ethos that I'm not sure if that's sustainable, right? But maybe it is. Maybe you can just every couple of years hire a new crop of young people right out of college. And I don't know what happens to the 40-year-olds and older, but that since my book came out, I get email every day from people who either have aged out or are worried about it. And starting at like 30, 32, right, worried about being too old to work in Silicon Valley, you know? Yeah, it's a very crazy situation.
Which is remarkable, I think, if you compare it to medical profession or the legal profession, where actually you're just getting into the prime of your career in sort of those ages.
Yeah, and which I think is part of what puts the lie to this idea. Part of what the argument for young people in tech is that old, you know, people who are afraid, you just don't get it, and it moves so fast, and it changes so much, and it's so challenging that you just need the special young brain with our digital native DNA. But for example, my sister-in-law is a surgeon at Stanford, and she's early 40, but really didn't begin her career because there's so much training. She's a colorectal surgeon, so she had to do specialized fellowships and trainings. So it was like her late 30s, really, before she began really practicing. I mean, she operates very complicated robotic surgery devices and that require constant learning. And she does the work she does is both physically and intellectually very, very rigorous work, and dynamic because the science continues to evolve. I mean, nobody says to her, whoa, geez, I don't know, 43, you know, clock's ticking, man, you know, really, we got to give this job to a 23-year-old because you just don't have the intellectual thing. So, yeah, in most fields, I think it's ridiculous to think that people over 40 can't do it. But, yeah, I think that's a fake argument. It's just it's cheap labor. Part of it is you can hire young people and work them really hard, and they don't have any life outside of this place. So they don't have any expectations of having any time off, yeah.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
So that was Dan Lyons. That was enjoyable, wasn't it, Dara?
Yeah, it was very, very funny.
That book is an extraordinary read, partly because, you know, normally when you read something like that, someone would, as we said there, would hide the company and would anonymise it. And actually, he names all the people at the very back of the book, the people he'd anonymised in the process. But it's just so brutally honest.
One of the things that I found really compelling was the fact that he felt twice as old as the average person.
So on the subject of diversity, so yeah. worth saying, so your name, Dara, is that Irish?
You know for well it isn't. I was born in Iran, pre-revolution.
Okay.
In the 70s, yeah. So I'm a full-blooded Iranian, both my parents are Iranian.
Okay, so you came to Britain where in the...
1980, so I lived in London.
I've heard of it.
I lived in the town called London in 1980 for 6 months before moving to Buckinghamshire.
Okay, so what was it like as an Iranian boy growing up in Bucks?
It's funny because I've thought about this a lot post-Brexit, funny enough, because I moved to Marlow in Buckinghamshire when I was five. And as I say, I'd been in the UK 6 or 7 months. When I arrived in the UK, I couldn't speak any English. So I just watched a lot of TV. And my parents spoke to me only in English to try to teach me. So when I joined my new school in Marlow, my parents were a bit worried that I'd be behind. So they saw the headmaster, and the headmaster he said, look, if he needs lessons or he needs tuition or if we can help him in any way, let us know. And he went, right, we're all over it, we'll check it. And then a week later, the headmaster called my parents back and said, look, Mr. and Mrs. Nasser, you've got nothing to worry about. His English is amongst the best in the class, because I'd been to school in London for a little while. And they were relieved, and you know. And whilst they were leaving, the headmaster kind of gave a little chuckle and said, look, don't worry. We've got experience of working with foreign children. We have another foreign boy. And my mother said, all right, where's he from? And the headmaster said, Wales. So that's a true story. But I think that was funny. But what that makes it sound like is that I could have been in for a rough ride. However, the one thing I'd say is I was celebrated for being different. So, and I remember this very fondly, and my parents talk about it. They'd come to sports day. And because I was the only person probably not from Buckinghamshire, let alone another country or Wales or whatever, when I was in sports day, everyone would cheer for me.
And the Welsh lad?
I can't remember. He's rubbish, I think. You know, who cares? Stop focusing on him. You know, so I can't remember the Welsh lad. But that was really... I always made to feel so welcome. And actually, that's what saddened me in the Brexit thing. And I didn't really think about it until after the vote. You know, the press have reported on Twitter of some of the people post-Brexit causing, you know, having a go at people, calling out their nationality, their origins, and telling them to go home. And you know what? What saddened me is that's exactly the opposite of what I felt. I felt really welcome. And I wasn't in London. I was in a town where there was no one of my, you know, background.
So, I mean, let's go on, because the theme of Dan Lyon's piece really is about, I guess, a couple of things. It's about diversity in the workplace.
Yeah.
And then he talks a bit about culture. And I think the focus he talks about, I mean, it's all about culture, but he talks about humour in the workplace. And he's actually very complimentary about Britain and humour. Do you think Britain is uniquely humorous? I mean, you've worked in an international company. Do British people have more of a focus on humour than other countries, do you think?
I don't know if I can give a purely objective view. I would say yes. I mean, the companies I have, everyone's been... The greatest... And I've said this a lot of time. The thing that drives me to come to work is that every day I come in and have fun. However difficult the job might be, how stressful it might be, how tough times are. And in the past, I've gone through, you know, various companies, tough times. And you also have good times. But however, it's the fun element that really drives me anyway. And I have to say, from day one, I remember when I was in TV, it was like a playground. I mean, it was just so much fun. You were learning all the time. You had to work really hard. They made it very clear, you probably don't actually have to work very hard, but if you want to get along, you do. So you weren't going to get sacked, probably, but if you wanted to advance, you had to work hard. But you're encouraged to have fun. And you're encouraged to learn and have fun with learning. And actually, that's the thing. I've loved it, Twitter. It's been so much fun, and it is so much fun, and every day, you know. So
I've got a theory about humour at work, and I think it largely comes down to national perception. Right. So I think broadly that countries whose inhabitants think truly they are the best people in the world tend to laugh less than the people who there's been a dawning realisation through their formative years, I'm not in the best country in the world. So specifically, I think if you grow up in Britain and you live in Britain, while we might have a sense of pride about some things and we like our music, and we think, even though the BBC only makes about 8 good shows a year, we think the BBC is good. Mm. We broadly know we're not the best country in the world. And so consequently, it brings us like a self-deprecating warmth to it. We laugh, our weather's rubbish, our
sports
rubbish, we celebrate defeat.
Yeah.
And so consequently, it brings the humour. We just laugh at everything. We're self-deprecating.
I think
we've
already
got failure baked into our expectations.
I think it does. I do have to say, I think it differs from profession to profession.
On the subject of diversity there, he talks about diversity and some of the horrors there. And I think he's candid to say, you know, he scanned his eyes across the floor and it was loads of white kids in their 20s. And there's a couple of ways that that ends up happening, that we say, you know, culture fit, would I have a beer with this person? And also, does this person feel, we've both worked in previous jobs where there's almost a adjective used, does this person feel like employee, they would fit in this big company? Mm. And actually, that's about trying to get someone who looks the same. I used to work somewhere. I'll give you this example. I used to work somewhere back in the past, a while ago now, where the woman who ran recruitment did what she saw as a collective good. She used to go through all the CVs, all the resumes that came in, and she would filter out, thankfully, very good service she was providing, she'd filter out all the names that were hard to pronounce.
Amazing.
A gentleman who might have a difficult to pronounce African name sadly wouldn't make the cut. Because colleagues in Preston might struggle to pronounce it.
Right. I mean, I don't think that would be referred to as optimal. I mean, if I, in my opinion, anyway.
Not best practice,
though. No, definitely not best practice. No, I think the other thing about the everyone having the same, being young and white or whatever, like Dan said, I think another thing that's come to light, tech company use referrals as their main way of recruitment, which is actually very, makes sense, right? Because why hire an agent at a lot of money to do this? And you need people in. A lot of tech companies used to hire people quickly. So if you know someone, Bruce, why don't you just get them in? And actually, there's a lot of work being done. Is typically you hang around with people who are like you. So you're likely to refer people who are like you, which means you're not going to get many diverse people. And I think that probably rings true. I don't think there's any bad intentions, it's just a, you know, it's a byproduct of having that process, I think.
What are companies doing to improve diversity and improve, like, hiring a broadly mixed team?
What's been proven to work is if you set yourself targets. So we need to employ X percent of certain people by a certain date. Now, for a lot of people, that sounds quite contrived. But it's a target, and apparently, with all the work done, companies that have targets versus companies that do not achieve those targets or much closer than those that do not. And one of the things that I heard a big media company do is they had a lot of jobs open and they looked at a lot of CVs and they were profiling a certain way. And they were saying, tell you what, go out, source some more CVs and try to increase people from different backgrounds, different gender, etc., etc. Then let's look at the CVs again and start the interview. Now, if you end up choosing the best candidate and they're from the original bunch, that's totally fine. But at least you've tried to diversify the recruitment process. Because to your point, with your extreme example, you were never going to interview anyone with a name you couldn't pronounce. Mm. Whereas this is like, well, we're beyond that, and then you employ the best person. Their diversity percentages have shot up or beaten their targets over the course of, you know, 5 or 6 years.
Right, it's materially changing the system.
And I suppose it's the mindset, isn't it? With the recruitment team or the sourcers, or call them what you will, go out, find, you know, a higher percentage of women, a higher percentage of, you can't go young or old, but people with different ethnic backgrounds. Bring them in for interview, or at least assess their suitability. And then if they get into the interview, they certainly stand a higher chance of getting a job if they're not even in the interview. So it's really helped them. And I think that's one way. I think another way that people do stuff is via internships. You know, and the apprentice levy and stuff that's going on right now in the UK. Now, university education, we were very lucky in our years that university was essentially free. You just had to pay living costs. Now people leave university with, what, £40,000 debt? So what they're finding is very clever children, when I say clever children, 18-year-olds leaving school, are thinking, I don't want £40,000 debt. I'm just going to get a job straight away. Now, the difficulty is a lot of the better jobs, you need a university education. So with the apprentice levy and the internships, they are allowing a way in for these people who might have less, you know, fewer qualifications. Now, you could argue, and I'm not making a wild stab in the dark, that a lot of these people who decide not to go to university probably come from slightly poorer backgrounds or lower socioeconomic, you know, backgrounds. So I think that that's another way, I think, to diversify at entry level.
But when it comes to diversity, is it all about changing laws or changing rules, or is it about everyone making personal contributions?
I think it's more of a behaviour thing, if I'm honest, or the personal. We were very lucky to do an unconscious bias training thing, actually, at Twitter.
So what does that mean?
So conscious bias, for clarity, is when you say, I'm not going to employ a woman because she's probably going to get pregnant and cost me money. That's conscious bias. Unconscious bias is when you naturally choose the man without really thinking about it, because you think. So, for example, the example they gave is if you have a male candidate and a female candidate for a police person, and there are, you know, they have exactly the same background, exactly the same experience. There was a massive majority of people chose the man over the woman. They didn't choose the man because he was a man. They didn't choose the man because he wouldn't get pregnant. They just chose the man. And that's the unconscious bias. You're doing it without knowing you're doing it, but there's still a factor in there. So we had this training, and one of the things that came out, I think it was from Harvard or Yale, I can't remember, was that the companies with more diverse background almost always not just had a better culture, like internal happiness scores, but performance.
One of the weird things about European law currently is you're not allowed to monitor the race, the ethnicity of employees.
Right.
But if globally a company does a report on their diversity, you're not allowed to monitor that in Europe. Don't worry, the Home Secretary is going to change that. She's going to monitor everything. But you're not allowed to monitor it. So you've got this weird thing where diversity is, certainly in Britain, if not in mainland Europe, more high profile than ever. Mm. But you can't even say whether you're doing a good job of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's not good, is it? I didn't know that, to be honest with you.
Because Dan Lyons, just to finish on Dan, he sort of paints a pretty pessimistic vision of work, doesn't he? It's a dystopian view of the world. And that you combine that with the fact that most people's jobs now is a lot of email and sort of managing stress to some extent. I know we can always look at our old man's job, look at our dad's job and think he had it easy. Mm. And then you extrapolate that forward and you think, Christ, what's work going to be like in 20 years?
Yeah. I think the Dan's bit I really like is that he was a journalist. I think journalists actually have quite a cynical view of the world, but actually it makes me laugh.
Yeah,
you know, I love it.
I think they need to, don't they?
Yeah, they need
to. They have to run everything through a truth filter.
That's exactly that, and I think that you have to run everything through a truth filter. I get it, but I think some of that no company's fun thing comes from his natural cynicism. I think, or his nurtured cynicism from however many years of journalism, I think. So I don't know. I think there's some great companies to work for. There's some great people having great fun. I mean, I don't think things are fundamentally different. I think probably the world's faster moving, so it might seem accelerated, but...
Good, and this is the sort of stage, so I've loved having you on. This is the stage I normally say to people, so, you know, what do you do, what's your job? Well, I know what you do, so you see anything good on telly?
Oh, yeah, so I like Modern Family, that's fun. I find it difficult to watch TV without a phone. So if I don't have, I find it hard to concentrate.
I think it's ruining telly, though, isn't it? Mm. That's why I do knitting.
I mean, you're really bad at watching anything, though, to be fair. The Affair's good, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good. Podcasts I listen to.
You know what? That's become...
That's where my comedy is.
Massive. Because I commute
every day. The Ramesh one.
He's
obviously amazing.
Ramesh, Hip Hop Saved My Life. Adam Buxton podcast. So funny.
Right.
The Comedian's Comedian.
I love the Mike Skinner and Murkage Day.
Yeah, you said. Audiobooks as well.
Yeah.
Amazing. So we've listened to the Partridge.
Alan Partridge audiobooks is incredible. Good. Thank you for staying after work and chatting to me, Doug.
It's absolutely fun. It's been absolutely amazing. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed meeting you on the sixth floor meeting rooms. Thank you.
Next time I'm on Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat, we've got the Professor of Economics, Professor Richard Layard. Do hope you'll join for that one. Please subscribe. Tweet me your feedback. See you next time.
Good.
It was quite serious, wasn't it?
You couldn't just. There was a few laughs in
there. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, you can't just come and fuck about.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.